started and grown several multi-million dollar businesses. His mission is to help you do the same. Welcome to the Business Growth Pod, building the future one entrepreneur at a time.
So you really do have to turn the page and move forward and be all in with what you're doing today. And if it doesn't work, understand that sometimes it doesn't work and you adjust and then you make a new plan. I think a lot of times from, you know, you talk about it from an athletic standpoint, you put a game plan together, right? And here's how it's going to go. Rarely does that game plan get followed through the entire game. You got to call audibles. You got to change it up.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Alan. I'm a family man, an attorney, and an entrepreneur. Each week, we provide resources and advice to help build your business. Are you ready? Then let's go. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show today. I love this. I love that one day I decided to start a podcast because it was quote unquote fun, right? I love that I get to talk to people and meet new people that have all sorts of experiences that I don't have, and I get to learn from them. Today, I'm super excited about our guest. I have a professional athlete on the show today, folks. How about that? All right. Not only that, it's a baseball player. Man, that hits home to me. Ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to play in the big leagues. That was all I really cared about. That and the latest Jordans, right? That was my life. My guest was a professional pitcher. He's an entrepreneur, and the last 20 years or so, he's spent in the home building and land development areas. And so I wanted to welcome Jason Jarvis to the show. Thanks for joining us today, Jason.
Thank you, Alan. Appreciate the intro. And, you know, I really wanted to play the big leagues too. I just wanted to do it a lot longer, but didn't quite work out that way. But it's great. It's a pleasure to be on. I've enjoyed listening to your other guests as well.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? Why were you interested in baseball? Let's start there.
Sure. So I grew up in Utah, a real baseball mecca, right? Where you get snow through all the winter.
Yeah. I should have played most of the year.
I grew up just north of Salt Lake City, up that way. And my dad really loved baseball. He didn't get a chance to play a lot in Little League and everything like that, just with his family circumstances, but he really loved it. And not too long after I was born, we moved to Southern California. So I spent about my first really 9 or 10 years down in Tustin in Orange County in California. You know, with the good weather down there, as my mom tells it, I would wait at the door for my dad to get home with my big red wiffle ball bat and the big white ball. And, you know, as soon as he walked in the door, it was like, let's go out and hit. And, you know, I've got old baby pitchers, you know, me at 2 years old, barely being able to walk and wanting to swing the bat. So I just, whether it was kind of bonding with my dad or just kind of took out from there, I really have just always enjoyed competing and was blessed enough to be a decent ball player and play at some fun levels.
That's pretty cool. You know, I think I love hearing the beginning of the story sometimes when we already know the end. We already know that you were able to achieve the highest level. And because you just told the story of millions of kids in the United States, right? Including me, right? That wanted to be a professional baseball player. But you did it, man.
It was a great time. Don't get me wrong. I loved every minute of it. But each level you kind of get to, it changes a little bit, right? Where you get up to, you know, the professional level and it does become more business-like. It's still the same game on the field, but it does become a lot more business-like with your performance and how quick you're moving up and what kind of value they place on you. And you do kind of become that chess piece or that pawn, and it does become a lot more business-like. So it does evolve, you know, from you make the high school team and it changes a little bit. You get a chance to go to college, it changes a little bit. You know, you go to pro ball. It's a fun path. One of the neat things that I've liked is everybody's path to get there. And then talking to tons of teammates and lots of friends who have done this, everybody's path's a little bit different. You know, everybody wants to be the Bryce Harper, the Mike Trout, where you're the number one prospect in all the nation. And you just know you're going to make $1 million when you get drafted. And, but those are the exceptions, not the rules. Most people have to kick and scraw and scratch and just really work for how they're going to get there, and really kind of separates those who are talented and those who are just, you know, overly competitive and have an amazing work ethic.
So at the professional level, and I don't know if you've ever thought about this or been asked this before, but at the professional level, what percentage of guys that are there rely pretty much solely on talent. What percentage of guys are not kicking, scratching, clawing to get there?
You're probably about 10%. And we used to kind of throw that around and talk about it. There's about 10% of the guys that get drafted that no matter what they do, they're just so talented, they're going to be in the big leagues very soon and probably play for quite a while, right? Again, those are the big names, you know, right? The Mookie Betts, the Mike Trouts, the Justin Verlanders, all these guys, you know, Roy Halladays. These are all guys that you just, they're highly scouted. They fly up through the minor leagues, they get to the big leagues and they make immediate impacts and they're just there. So about 10% of those guys are that way. Everywhere else, everybody has tools, right? Everybody has a tool. That's why you got scouted. I mean, when they scout you in baseball, it's the five tools. It's can he hit for average? Can he hit for power? Can he run? Can he play defense? And can he throw? And they rate those tools. And so everybody has at least, you know, two to three of those tools. The less tools you have, the better your tools that you do have better be, right? So if you can't run or throw, you better be able to hit the snot out of the ball and you better be able to hit it very far in order to make it. So it's a really unique system when you see everybody's different abilities and how they mold their game to what they have. It's because if you can run, then you better be able to steal bases. You better be a defensive wizard, and then they'll see what they can tolerate with your bat. So there's always a little bit of a give and take. But the rest of us, you know, from a pitching standpoint, everybody's can throw strikes. Most everybody throws, you know, pretty hard. That's why you got drafted. It's now a matter of, how can I get guys out? What's my hit to walk ratio? What separates me to make me different from the other 90% that I'm competing with? And that's really what it boils down to. I talk with my son. I have a young ball player who's in college right now. He's a sophomore that's playing. And we talk about that since he was 12 years old, is you're going to be on these club teams and you're going to get to high school. And when you get to college, everybody's talented. The next level that you move up, what do you have that makes you different than this guy? Now that he's starting to get scouted a little bit, what are you doing that is going to make the scout look at you over, you know, Joe, John, and Jeff that are sitting over there on your team? And that's really what it's different for every player. And that's kind of the fun. That's what you have to figure out.
So at what age did your son start getting into baseball, start realizing what you had accomplished and get to the point where he was wanting to be like dad?
Well, you know, I have three kids. I have an older boy, a daughter in between, and then the younger, and all three of them were very active. And I think you're just dad. They hear about stories, but they just kind of figure everybody did that, right? You're just dad. You know, you don't know what you're talking about. So they were always active. My older boy played quite a bit, and he got into wrestling and volleyball, which was so great to watch because I didn't know much about either. So it was really fun to kind of just cheer for him and not try to overcoach him. My younger boy, he was always active. He was never a video game kid. He always just wanted to be out doing something. So whether it was shooting hoops, riding bikes off jumps, or playing wiffle ball in the backyard, he was always really active and he was pretty good at it. He was a very coachable kid, which sometimes is hard with dads, right? Because you're just dad and you butt heads because you get tired of hearing from you. So he was always pretty coachable and really just kind of took it on his own. And he played through the lower levels. And really, when he got to high school, of course, he grew a ton. He's a beast now. He's 6'3", 6'4", 215, 220 pounds, runs like a deer. So it just really makes me sick because at least while they are my genes, mine weren't that good.
So I always have this question for parents that played at, you know, some level after high school, some sport, whatever it is. And that is, if you heard your children's coaches give incorrect advice, what do you do in that scenario? During a game or during practice? Let's take it one step further and say that it's something that there's a technical flaw, right? You overhear your son's coach teaching him how to throw the ball incorrectly. What do you do in that scenario?
You know, that's a very, very good question because you have to walk a fine line because I really wanted to instill in my kids the respect factor, right? That you need to respect the coach. You need to understand what he's telling you and you need to work on it because if he's telling you you're not doing something right, if you don't fix it, you could not be playing because of it. So you want to walk that fine line of not being a meddling parent and keep making sure he's doing something right that you know is wrong. I was pretty fortunate. I didn't have a lot of that. He had pretty good coaches coming up. We ran into that a little bit, to be honest with you, when we got to the college level, where they start wanting to change everything that you had done to get there, and you just wasn't having any success with it. It just felt awkward. It was tough for him to change what he'd been doing for, you know, 18 years of his life up to that point. So sometimes you just have to tell coach, you nod your head and say yes, and do what works for you when you're in the box. Because at the end of the day, the results are the results. And if you're not getting the results, then you're not going to play. So if you have something else that's in your mind that's prohibiting you from performing at your best, then shame on you for letting it bother you. You need to try to do what you feel. It's all about confidence, right? It's all about that makeup. And if you think you can or you can't, you're right. You know, we've all heard that a million times, but it is so true in sports when you're competing, that if you've got something in the back of your mind and you're trying to hit a 95 mile an hour fastball, and it for a split second keeps you from reacting properly, you're beat. And so you really got to stay focused and make sure that there's nothing that's deterring from what you're trying to do in the game situation that's not going to slow you down. So that's kind of how we would handle it. We would talk about it a lot. I never tried to get any confrontations with the coaches. I had decent relationships with a lot of them, and we'd talk baseball. And luckily for me, playing at a high level, a lot of times I'd get asked some questions. Well, what do you think about this? And what do you think about that? And that would kind of open the door a little bit for me to, hey, I heard you saying this. Tell me your reasoning why you think that's so good. And maybe we could kind of agree to disagree at the end of the day. But the most of the time it was like, oh, I didn't think of it like that. That's a good point. So I just didn't want to be the meddling guy, because it's his path. It's his career. So want him to figure some things out on his own as well.
Did you ever encounter moments when your children in whatever sport were going through some type of hardship, didn't make the team, had a bad game, was in the middle of a slump, something like that, that you yourself went through at that age or at some age before parenthood, and think to yourself, man, it's a little different perspective because I have been through that and it's not the end of the world. Like, I've been in slumps before, right? I never played baseball past high school. But when you're in a slump, you think it's never going to end. Yeah, I mean, baseball players are they're super superstitious. It's like, this is my career. And so did you ever, with your children, recognize moments where they were going through some type of hardship and you recognize, hey, I actually went through something like that and I feel completely different about it now than I did at the time that I was going through it?
Absolutely. I will tell you, as a parent, it is 100 times worse watching your kid do it than I ever felt playing. I feel more pressure and get more of my heart rate up and beating, and I'm pacing back and forth around watching the game when my kids were playing. Then I don't think my pulse ever got above like resting rate, unless it was a really big situation, because you just learn how to handle it and certain things are in your control. When you're watching your kid, nothing's in your control. And of course, you hate to watch them fail because you don't want to watch the droop shoulders and the tears and the, you know, upset, and they let my team down and everything that comes along with that. But it's those moments that are the biggest teaching moments, not just for sports, but in life, right? When you feel that burden and then you actually come through in a great moment, I mean, what a swing of emotions. It's really hard to watch them. But yeah, I mean, we talk about it constantly. And I think I can share a good perspective because I have been there. And now that we kind of have that mutual respect, not just with him, but other ball players that I've talked and worked with over the years, it's just trying to keep it in perspective. You know, look, I know it's the end of the world. That really sucked today, but it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. You know, it's a 162 game season. You're only as good as your last at bat. So get them tomorrow. And here's what we need to change. We do a lot of recaps. What felt good? What felt uncomfortable? Dad, I just didn't see the ball today. I couldn't pick it up out of his hand. Okay, so how do we fix that moving forward? You know, and just talk about little things and tricks. And there's always something positive. Even in an 0-for-4 night, there's always something that you can talk about. We would always pick something that we thought we did good that day, and then pick something that maybe wasn't so good that we need to get better at if we want to continue to take the game to the next levels.
So how does this concept, I love that you brought this up, how does this concept of kind of having a short memory How does that apply in the business world? For all of us, that a lot of my listeners, they're entrepreneurs at different stages. Some of them are considering, some of them haven't even started their own business, right? They're working for somebody else, but that's their dream. That's their vision. And then I have people, they're into this thing years and years and years, just trying to get to the next level. And so how does this concept of, man, yeah, you swung at a bad pitch. Yeah, hey, you invested money in the wrong stock, or, you know, you made a mistake with hiring somebody you shouldn't have. How does that help in the business world?
Oh, I think, you know, it sometimes can sound kind of cliche, but yesterday is yesterday. So you really do have to turn the page and move forward and be all in with what you're doing today. And if it doesn't work, understand that sometimes it doesn't work and you adjust and then you make a new plan. I think a lot of times from, you know, you look, talk about it from an athletic standpoint, you put a game plan together, right? And here's how it's going to go. Rarely does that game plan get followed through the entire game. You got to call audibles. You got to change it up with what your eyes are telling you and with what you're seeing is actually happening. And so I think, you know, in business, that's a big thing as well. We make mistakes. We make bad calls. You know, hopefully we learn from it. We don't make the same mistakes twice. I talk with a lot of the guys that I work with or work under me. We're going to make mistakes. What we can't do is keep making the same mistake twice. You know, we learn from it, we got to move on. But if we keep making the same mistake over and over, you know, there's a coaching opportunity that we need to do to figure out if this is the right guy in that role, or how are we going to move on from it? I think people from an entrepreneur standpoint, when you set up a plan, and if you hit it, and you probably know this better than I do, Alan, if your plan goes perfectly the way that you mapped it out 2 years ago, God, you really nailed it, because it is really hard to do that and to execute it to perfection, because there's so many outside variables, the market, interest rates, just what's going on in the submarkets and those general areas that can affect your plan that you can't predict 2 years ago. You relate that a lot to sports. You may have had a plan of what I was trying to do my first at bat, but you know what? It needs to completely change, because what I thought I was going to see, I didn't see. Here's how I think he's working with me the second at bat, so that you can make that adjustment. Because I think with sports and with business, the really good ones are constantly making the little adjustments to keep themselves on top. And so I think that's probably the best way to relate that.
I heard this story one time, and I'm trying to remember which banking magnate it was about, but I think it was JP Morgan or somebody back 100 years ago, give or take. Mm-hmm. And he had this person that was working for him that made a $200,000 mistake or something, which would equate today to several million dollars. And this guy came into Morgan's office kind of with his tail between his legs, and he was worried because he thought he was going to lose his job. And so he goes in there and he's like, yeah, I'm sorry. Well, I guess I'll go pack up my stuff. And Morgan's like, what do you mean, man? I just invested 200 grand in you. You're not going anywhere. Right. So I think that goes back to your comment of saying, hey, let's not make the same mistake twice. That's the nice thing about making mistakes, if we react to them properly. Right. And I think that people, there are all sorts of different reactions. And 2020 has been a crazy year, and there's been a lot of, you know, I'm going to throw my hands in the air. There's nothing I can do about it. And there are people that they make mistakes and they let it beat them down. And as a pitcher, man, hats off, just the mentality of a pitcher. I mean, your job is to basically make it so that other people don't have a job, right? It's not necessarily the case with a left fielder. The left fielder, mm-hmm. he'll catch occasional fly ball, make a great, you know, diving play or a throw out a home plate. But your job is basically to make people look stupid. And so how did that? Right, exactly. But those mistakes, how did you, and pitchers, man, it's like, there's no role in sports. I'm a huge sports fan. Sports are my life in a lot of ways.
It's great.
There is no other position that I think, and maybe rightfully so, maybe deservedly so, the amount of blame or credit lies on solely one position. Maybe quarterback in football, maybe we're starting to get there, but how did you take those mistakes, those failures? What was the mentality those things happen?
You know, honestly, if you're a competitor, if you like competing and you like sports, you live for those moments, right? That's why you play the games. You don't play the games where you can get in and beat up on a team when it's 17-1. you know, and they're already down in the dumps and they're just flat overmatched. You know, those aren't fun games. The fun games are the ones where, hey, these guys have nine hitters up and down the lineup that if I'm not on, every one of them is going to make me pay. And if you go in with the mindset of I can't fail or I have to make a perfect pitch every time, you are going to fail because nobody's going to make a perfect pitch every time. So really, I mean, on the days when you're successful with that, you know, you want to be in that moment. You want the ball on your shoulders. You know, the biggest compliment that I think you can be given is when your teammates are in a big moment and they look at you and say they want you to have the ball. I mean, there's no better compliment I can think of than that. And that's what I think from a competitive standpoint, you're striving to do. That's the difference between, I think, people who are successful and people who are just talented. Is there's a lot of talented, and interrelated related to the business world, there's a lot of smart, intelligent people out there, right? That can do the equations, that can tell you read balance sheets and tell you all the financial metrics and what that means. But there's very few superstars who can make it happen consistently. And that kind of separates the people who are talented from the people who are just really, really good and phenomenal, you know, phenomenal athletes or phenomenal business people. And it's just that mindset of I'm going to go out and I'm not nervous about if this is going to happen. I want to go out and see what happens. You know, I'm not afraid to fail. That's the biggest thing I'd say. We had chatted a little bit before the call on some of the items to maybe talk about. And one of the ones I really liked was kind of what separates the good from the great. And really, I think it's the ability that they're not afraid to fail. They've either failed earlier and they learn from it. I failed a lot in my life. I mean, I've been fairly successful the last, you know, 5-10 years. However, that's because I failed so much the 10 years before that. And I finally figured out what I wanted to do and how to do it. So I quit making those stupid mistakes. Same with baseball. You know, you have a bad game, you better make an adjustment or you're not going to be pitching very many more games. So you kind of have to if that's the level that you want to be at.
Yeah, so you've developed this mentality, or perhaps you were born with it, where you're not afraid of a good challenge. And I think it's not only almost cliche, but it's kind of, I can hear my listeners just thinking, yeah, that's different though, right? That's different because that's sports, not as much as on the line, right? I was talking with a gentleman the other day and he was telling me that he wants to start a business. And I said, dude, do it, man. Do it. You're going to regret not doing stuff in your life a lot more than you'll ever regret doing stuff. And he's like, yeah, but you know, my wife's pregnant and we're worried about, and I can't make decisions for people, right? I'm wondering, Jason, for you, what is it that if somebody doesn't have that mentality where they're like, I was born for this, man, there's tie game, there's a runner on second, their best hitter is, I want to be in there, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, my wife's pregnant. I don't have very much money in the bank, but I also don't want to work for somebody the rest of my life. I want to be in there. How does somebody develop that attitude, that mentality that doesn't naturally have it?
I think you have to go through it. And that's not for everybody. You know, I was listening to your podcast with Wayne, your CrossFit athlete, you know, the Ironman guy, and he was awesome. I liked how he said, you know, sometimes then this may not be for you, but I don't think you know until you've tried it. And that's the biggest thing. I don't know how people think they're going to feel about those moments until they've gotten to that moment and put themselves in it to try it. Same with sports. How do you know if you can come through on a 3-2 pitch with the bases loaded and two outs till you've been in that situation? You know what the emotions are going to be like. You know what your heart's going to be feeling like. And can you get it back in control to compete? Or is the moment going to overtake you and just eat you like a dog? And I think that's the same from the business standpoint. You don't know until you try it. And some people will thrive in it and find out it's not so bad and I can do this. And other people will get so nervous and hesitant and want to micromanage everything and not stick with what they thought they were going to do. And they fail. And so there's nothing wrong with that as long as you learn from it so that the next time you do it, you're better because of it. And you look at a lot of younger athletes when they're in big playoff situations, and sometimes they come through, but most of them typically struggle. And it's not because they're not talented, good people, or good athletes. You have to learn how to perform in the moment. because it's a whole different when it's game 130 in August and it's 97 degrees and you're in Baltimore, who's 30 and 60, you know, 30 and 100, because they've been so bad lately. And it's just another game, to when it's the sixth game of the ALCS and it's a winner go home for you because you're down 3-2, and who's going to be on that mound? And it's a whole different set of emotions. It's a whole different way of preparation. There's a whole different buzz at the ballpark. I mean, it's all over talk radio. It's all over newspapers. It's, you know, social media. It would be interesting to play now with all the immediate news that comes out, and it would be hard not to read it and not let it bother you if it was negative because yeah. It's so available. For us, it was newspapers, right? So you were already gone to the next town the next day. You didn't get a chance to read about how terrible your outing was.
Yeah, by that point, it didn't really matter.
You just moved on.
Yeah, exactly. So my whole thing is, for everybody that's listening, if you want my advice, I'm going to tell you to take the leap. I'm going to tell you to take the risk. I'm going to tell you to stop being afraid. So if you don't want me to tell you that, do not call me. Do not message me. Do not ask for my advice. Because what I get a lot of times, Jason, I get people calling me and messaging me and saying, hey, Alan, this is what I want to do, but... And I think in the back of their minds, they want me to say, yeah, no, dude, don't do it, man. Don't do it. Stay in your comfort zone. Stay at your 9-to-5. You know, spend 30 yep. years. You know yep. what's scary to me? Is staying in a 9-to-5 for 30 years with this big dream that I can't get out of my head. Now, if you're a 9-to-5, perfect, that's fine. But that's not the people that listen to this podcast. Those aren't the people that I speak with.
I kind of look at those guys as the teammate that as soon as they show up 5 minutes before stretch, just enough time to put on their spikes and get out there in time. And as soon as the game's over and coach says they can go home, they're already out the dugout and they're on their way home. That's just kind of how I relate yeah. it and how I look at that. Because yeah. everybody says they want to be successful, right? I mean, I'd be surprised if you've ever talked to anybody who went, no, I'm really okay. I'm really okay with what I'm making, and I'm fine with doing that the rest of my life, you know? Nobody wants to do that. Everybody wants to hit the home run in the big spot. Everybody wants to make the $1 million a year and set up their financial well-being for life. But it doesn't just happen. It's not given to you. Those people have something that they went out and did for it. And so it's the same in athletics. You know, the guys that were really successful were the guys that showed up an hour before they needed to be and got in their extra work, stayed an hour or two later, got their workouts done and did the extra hitting or worked on whatever they were struggling with so that they could get out of it. I mean, everybody says they don't want to fail, but who's actually going to put in the effort? That's the difference. That's what sets people apart.
Exactly. So I can break it down to two types of people. There's the people that are looking for an excuse, and then there's the people that are looking for a way to figure it out. They're looking mm-hmm. for something that's going to motivate them to take the leap, to finally do it, right? They've been doing whatever it is, and they want something different. This is your calling card. Everyone's looking for a sign, or they're looking for, you know, I'm going to wait till the next year. Or I'm going to wait till this is your sign, folks. It's time. Okay.
Alan, I have a question for you. If you were going to go into business with somebody, who would you be looking for?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about, right?
You're going to look for the grinders. You're going to look for the guys that, you know, right or wrong, whether this succeeds or not, who do you want in that trench with you that you know if it doesn't work, then it wasn't meant to be, because I know it's not going to be from a lack of effort or a lack of planning. You know, yeah. We're going to be prepared to make it happen. I can say that about a lot of teammates. You know, I don't care if we win or lose, but I want this guy in the lineup. I want this guy at short. I want this guy in right field, and I want this guy catching me. Because win or lose, I know they're going to put everything on the line that needs to be done. And that's who I want to go to battle with.
Yeah. And I think it's the exact same in the business world where, and I think even a little more so than with athletics, because in business, it's never what you have planned out. It's never what you think it's going to be like day one. No major company, no company in any fashion that's successful is exactly as the entrepreneurs, the founders decided mm-hmm. on day one. So I want to surround myself with people that are like, you know what, come hell or high water, I'm going to be right there next to you. And I don't know exactly what we're going to end up doing, and I don't know exactly how things are going to work out, but I am going to tell you this, I am not going to quit, and I am going to do everything I can possibly do to make sure that we're successful. That's the type of person I want next to me.
I agree. And that's what I think is great, because I see a lot of book smart people. They've got a lot of initials after their names. And I think education is fantastic. Don't get me wrong. Everybody has to have some. But I also see none of those people able to succeed or run a project or able to navigate anything in business because they don't have that knack. There's some people that you can just give a task to and no other direction, and they'll go figure it out and how to get it done. And those are the people that I will take any day of the week over somebody who's got the Harvard business degree and a lot of initials, because I don't know if that guy really knows how to get it done.
Exactly.
He's smart.
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't know if he can get it done.
Because at the end of the day, a lot of it doesn't have to do with what's in your head. It has to do with what's in your heart, man. Like, hey, I'm going to get my ass kicked, but I'm going to keep playing. So, well, Jason.
Yeah.
Tell me about the biggest pitch you ever threw, the most important pitch you've ever thrown.
Boy, that's a good question. I mean, there's been a lot of really, really big outings. I don't know that I could say biggest pitch. I mean, there's been a few scenarios. I remember my first year in pro ball. I was in Oneonta, New York, in the New York Penn League. It's a short season A-ball league. And I remember I was kind of trying to make my way with the Yankees. I had just recently been drafted. And I got thrown into a situation, I think it was like second and third, one out. So the goal is to try to get a strikeout right from the first guy up so that you get the second out. And then the third guy, he can put it in play and you can make an out and get out of the inning. And I remember we worked it. I got an out. No, we walked a guy because we were trying to pitch around him because we had the base open. And then we got an out. And so I had bases loaded and we got to full count. And I remember the catcher three times called fastball. And I was like, nah, I'm going to throw this guy a slider right here. That's what I felt good with. And I knew, and it was risky, right? Because it's like the general rule of thumb is throw a strike, throw a pitch that he has to put in play. Don't give him the free pass. That's what the playbook would tell you. But I just felt confident in that. And he called time and came out. And I'm like, call the damn slider. And so he went back and we threw it. And the guy swung over it. If he would have taken it, it would have been a ball. But I had just thrown him a couple fastballs. And I just felt, hey, I can get him on this. And it got us out of a big situation in a tight game. And we ended up coming back and winning the game. So that was one of the first time where I kind of really took it on my shoulders with what I wanted to do and not just what the catcher was calling for signs. And that really kind of taught me to be in control of my game and make sure I was throwing what I was comfortable with and not just going with somebody else's suggestions. Because, you know, sometimes catchers just throw down signs because they're lazy. And I've thrown to a lot of great catchers, and the ones that fought with you and understood what you were trying to do, those were guys you loved throwing to. But sometimes catchers were lazy and they just threw down signs because they knew if it was a breaking ball and it was in the dirt, they'd have to block it.
Right. So that's why he's asking for the fastball.
Exactly. And it happens all the time with runners on first base because they have a better chance of throwing out the runner
yeah.
if you throw a fastball rather than a right. off speed, and they get fastball happy. So,
gotcha. So that was one of the biggest pitches that you've ever thrown. Tell me about the last pitch you ever threw.
Boy, the last pitch I ever threw would have been in 97. To be honest with you, I don't even know that I've ever been asked that. I don't actually remember that, Alan. That's a good question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that. It would have been towards the end of the season. I think it was in the last game because kind of the unwritten rule in the last game of the season after you played so many is we're not taking pitches. Hitters don't want to take pitches because they're ready to the road if they're out of the playoffs. And if you're in the playoffs, you're just ready to get to the playoff round. And so it really is kind of those unwritten rules where you'd have a 9-inning game in an hour and 40 minutes. I mean, that was the goal. Can we have a game under an hour 40?
Everybody's so taking pitcher, hacks.
So pitchers, you're not throwing breaking balls, just throw strikes. Hitters, if you can see it and hit it, you better swing. And so those games are kind of fun. Those are things that fans don't really quite understand on getaway days or those last days of the season that everybody just wants to get out of there as quick as they can because it's been a long grind.
That's interesting. So you don't really remember the last pitch you ever threw?
I don't, because I didn't know if I was going to retire or not at that point, to be honest with you. It had been a little bit of a rough year. I found out that off season that my wife was pregnant with my daughter. And so we were going to have our second child and she would end up being due in August, which means that they wouldn't be able to be out with me for most of the year because she'd need to be home closer to the doctor. And it kind of evolved over that off season that I decided not to go back. And so I didn't know it was my last pitch at the time.
Let's say that you did know. Let's say that you knew that that would be your last season. Do you do anything differently?
You know, I would have relished the moment a little bit more, because I just think when you're out there playing, it kind of just becomes your daily routine. And I think I appreciate how fun and how neat it was and what a journey it was the further I've been removed from it. And I see what working 9 to 5 is like. How much more fun it was to just go to the baseball game and go to the yard and talk with fans and get your workout in. But so I really relish. And that's what I tell a lot of young ball players. I'm like, you've got a lot of time to work in your life. If you really like this, work at this and see how far it can take you. Because, you know, I hear a lot of guys, oh, I think I'm going to get a job because I could walk in and I could start making 40 grand a year. And in the minor leagues, you don't make a lot of money. I mean, you're talking 1500 bucks a month, you know, 2000 bucks a month if you get up to AAA, things like that. So you're not getting rich, that's for sure. And I talk to some of these guys that are wavering, and I'm just like, if you're done, you're done. But if there's any glimmer at all, I'm like, just keep going, because you will miss the smells of the clubhouse and getting on that stinky bus and the crappy food that you eat. I said, you're going to miss that one day, and you're going to sit there at your desk looking at your computer, sending emails and remembering, God, I remember what BP was like and the sounds and the music playing. And so I just try to really encourage them to just, if you're done, make sure you're done. But if there's a glimmer in your eye, keep going, because if you don't go out on your terms, you'll regret it.
I think there's an analogy to be had with this, because a lot of my listeners may or may not have been athletes. They're definitely not really now.
But I'll tell you, if they're entrepreneurs, I bet they're competitive. Whether they were great athletes or not, you know, some people are blessed with more than others. But the one thing that I do see in common with successful people is they got a little bit of a competitive edge to them. They don't want the other guy to win. And that's athletics.
100%. And that competition is in business, no matter what industry you're in. And I think it's a little different, because a lot of times it's not just one company, like it's one team trying to beat you, right? It's everybody. It's people from other industries trying to get their piece and stuff. But I think there is this analogy that as we're kind of going through hell, especially with startups, and especially as you're growing a company is super painful, man. It's super difficult adding personnel and spending money, investing into yourself and your businesses. And I think that as we're doing this, and I'm always in the middle of that because I'm always trying to grow my companies. That's just the personality that I have. But I think I should take your advice and I should savor it a little more, because I don't know what next year is going to bring, right? I don't know when I'm going to have to hang up the proverbial cleats.
Yep. Yeah. Savor the wins, savor the positives, you know, savor the successes, especially with a sport like baseball, right? Where you fell 7 out of 10 times, you're a 300 hitter, you make the Hall of Fame. So it's nothing but failure. Savor the good moments. You know, I've been golfing a lot lately, love to golf. And boy, do I savor that nice shot.
Oh, yeah.
It seems like not many of them come anymore. And it's always on the 18th hole, and it's probably the approach shot to the green after a horrible round. And you just flush that 7-iron and it bounces 5 feet from the cup, and you're like, I'll be back tomorrow.
Yep. Golf has a way of just getting its claws into you and not letting go.
But it's just so fun to compete. You know, it's just, you can't get that out of your blood. If you're a competitor, it doesn't matter if it's family games around the kitchen table or if it's golf or if it's next year's projections. If you're competitive, you're competitive. And those people tend to be successful.
So, Jason, tell me about a time in your life that you wish you had a do-over card, where you could just extend the card into the air and then poof, you have a new chance.
Just one? Just one? Just,
you Four. Only get one. Hey, that's more than anybody else gets.
Well, I've got about 10 or 12 big failures that I'd like to go back and redo. I really don't try to live with a lot of regret, right? When I'm in on something, I'm all in. I would have liked to have continued playing a little bit longer. That would probably be the one poof. But, you know, at the time I was expecting my second child and I didn't want to be away from them, right? I didn't like being away from my family. I'm kind of a family guy. I love being around my kids. And that was hard for me, which is why I made the decision, like, I guess it's just time to be a dad. And I don't regret it, But I do think it would have been fun to give it another year or two to really see if I could have turned that corner.
I think as humans, we think in a very interesting way, right? We think, oh man, I wish I could do that over again. Especially the longer time goes on, the more we wish we could have that do-over card. But we don't ever think, well, how would that have affected other areas of my life, right? There's this movie with Adam Sandler called Click, right? Where he has this remote and he can fast forward, rewind, pause his life. But it affects all these other things, right? He's trying to skip the tough stuff, but then it messes up life with his kids and his wife. And I think that's what's great about the human mentality is, especially the way you just phrased it, you know what? I don't have many regrets. And I think that's a great answer to that question, because we don't know a lot of times what we would have lost if we could do it over again and do it the way we thought we should have done it.
I agree. No, I agree. I always look at it this way. My biggest failure, and people ask, I end up doing a lot of city council planning and zoning meetings with my career now, you know, where we have to go and we have to present a project and we're trying to kind of sell them on why this is good for them. And sometimes they go great and sometimes they're not so much, but it's kind of like prepping for a game, right? We got to put our game plan into you're going to handle this and who's going to handle that and then see how it all comes together and if you can get the win. But none of that's going to ruin my day. Right. I mean, none of that. I mean, I may be a little bummed out for a little bit if we didn't get it, especially when you put a lot of time and effort into something. But if you give it your best effort, then there's nothing to hang your head about. Right. And that's a big thing you hear a lot in sports and in any competition is if you know in your heart that you gave it everything you had and it didn't work out, then it didn't work out. You can pout about it. It's not going to change it. You turn the page, you move on, you get ready for the next one. And that's where I think it kind of goes back to that short-term memory in athletics, why those guys are successful. Because if you gave it your all and you left it on the table, you got nothing to hang your head about. It didn't work. We move on.
Love it. So Jason, tell me a little bit about what you did after your playing days. What did you do professionally?
Oh, so professionally, I bounced around a little bit. I was a mortgage loan officer for a number of years. I worked in trucking, doing logistics for a trucking company for a while. And then the last 20 years, I kind of spent in home building, land development and acquisition more particularly. But for a while, kind of during the downturn when construction was slow, I actually bought a baseball bat company and moved it to Chandler, Arizona, called Zinger Bats, and started running that to try to get back into baseball. Because ever since I had been out of it, I just had that itch to do something back in baseball. And that was kind of a good opportunity to do that.
Is it important to do something, whether it's start a business or work in a field or find interest in a field, with something that you're passionate about?
I think the lucky people that can find something where you can make a dollar and put it in your pocket and save some for the next day and you enjoy what you do. I mean, to use the sports analogy, that's hitting the home run right there. When you can wake up and be really passionate about what you're doing, it's not work. It becomes just a part of who you are and what you do to put food on the table. And that's kind of how I looked at the bat company a little bit. You know, we got a chance to get in and the company's still doing well today. I was in it for about 3-4 years and then I ended up taking some other opportunities and sold my piece out to my partner. But I still talk to him often. I'm still kind of involved or I'll have people contact me about bat orders. But I really think that if you're into what you're doing, it becomes so much easier to succeed as well, right? I mean, I don't know very many successful people that hate what they do. I don't.
That's a great point.
Maybe you do. Maybe you do, but I don't know very many people who are successful that don't enjoy what they do or the people that they work with or the challenges that they have to navigate. And that to me is what it's really all about. Whether you're working for a bigger company or you're doing it on your own, if you can find that team, if you can find something that you're passionate about that you enjoy waking up to do, then to me, I think that's the top of the mountain.
I love it, man. Jason, this was awesome. I love having an opportunity to talk about sports, period. But the way that you were able to kind of teach us some life and business lessons with your experience playing professional baseball was just fantastic. Very entertaining, man. I appreciate you. I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us today.
No, I appreciate it, Alan. It's been great. I mean, there's definitely far others who are far more successful at it than me, but I think I learned as many lessons as they did. I failed a lot more, so I learned a lot more lessons.
There you go. All right, man. Thanks, Jason.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Alan.
If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please leave us a rating. And for daily inspiration and business tips, follow Alan on Instagram. Until next time, remember, we build the future one entrepreneur at a time.